Okay, hi everybody, and here we are at Externalization of the Hierarchy Program number 29. Not knowing how many hours, of course, even if one. But anyway, it's the 23rd of February, and we're beginning a new section, so I thought it well to conclude at 1 hour for the old section. We have now studied the two of the great invocations, and the last one was powerful indeed, and I think, well, they're all powerful in different ways, and I think you've seen through the Tibetans' definitions of various words that we cannot necessarily take things at face value. For instance, that light and love and power and death fulfill the purpose of the coming one. Death is relinquishment, sacrifice. It's not physical plane death. And, you know, we learn various intentions of the ancient writers of the great invocations. Now we're ready to begin something called the forces behind the evolutionary progress of the race. Well, this is section 3. I'm not really sure how many sections we have, maybe 7 in this book, something like that. And we've done about 224 pages, something like that. So the forces behind the evolutionary progress of the race and the doctrine of the avatars. And you see, we have skipped quite a bit. We have gone from, is it September? Maybe September, October, November. Anyway, we've gone from late 1940 into 1941. So at least 6 months have elapsed there. And we have to remember that in June, the very beginning of June, this Operation Barbarossa took place, where Germany opened up a two-front war and attacked Russia along a very wide frontier. Very long frontier. It was the beginning of the end, and a year and a half later, Germany was defeated in Russia. As we enter the momentous month of May this year, I suppose, you know, because of the WASAC particularly, I've asked myself if there is any way in which I can arouse the world aspirants and my disciples to a truer appreciation of the imminent significance of the presented opportunity, and also if there is any way in which I can simplify and make more real to you the doctrine of the coming one, linked as it is to the teaching of every great religion. In all of them, the idea of a subjective spiritual order concerned with the developing welfare of humanity is to be found. Well, we can see that the Tibetan's purpose is somehow to arouse his disciples and to help create a better understanding, because apparently he deems it not sufficient, and the degree of arousal not sufficient. So he works for simplification. You know, you can kind of imagine a university professor coming into the kindergarten and trying to convey something of what he knows. So every great religion, he says, the doctrine of the coming one has as its central point, even though the names will be different. And that's something which the modern Orthodox Christian has to understand, that other flocks have I which are not of this fold, as the Christ has said, and one has to share his leadership with others who may call him by a different name. And right there, a certain amount of pettiness is to be noted, and selfishness and exclusiveness, and separations caused by the misinterpretations which are the result of the application of the concrete mind without broader understanding. This is an age of culminations, you know, climaxes. Such culminations appear today in the field of religion, as well as in the field of science and politics, all the great lines of human approach to reality and to truth are passing through, passing out of the realm of the tangible and exoteric into the intangible and esoteric. The ethereal promise of the Aquarian Age is occurring, and we're moving into an appreciation that the true physical nature of man is the etheric body. And, you know, this is this is a great step, and with certain researchers, we've gone farther and farther. It isn't widely accepted, but the emphasis upon health and sort of vitality, let's say, you know, which is akin to prana, this has emerged, and we are heading in the right direction, let us say. Science is rapidly becoming the science of the unseen and of the unprovable. Well, maybe more towards provability has come about, and we're moving into the occult mind, and we're moving from the Martian science into the Uranian science. Well, it's said of Mars, it's objective and full of blood. Neptune is subjective and full of life, and Uranus rules the occult mind. So really entering the realm of what has hitherto been the intangibles, but there are increasing ways of coming to grips with and seeing the results of the apparently intangible. I guess all we'd have to do is go to the CERN facility, CERN, a great, atom smasher, so to speak, in the search for subatomic particles, and we would see that the unseen is becoming at least indicated. Religion has emerged from the realm of the mystical into the clearer atmosphere of the occult, at least among certain people. For many, it's still the mystical, and for others, it's still Saturnian, thou shalt and thou shalt not, and must now emphasize the reality of the unseen as the efficient cause of the seen. Politics and government are engaged with processes of thought and ideologies, realizing that these are the true drivers, you know. So there's an etherealization occurring, and when it comes to Aquarius, that's what we expect. An etherealization indicating the importance of the etheric dimension of man and of all life forms, and I suppose of ideas as well, given the magical process. What then is the true inner structure of reality which will provide the needed strength for humanity at this time, thus sufficing to satisfy man's demand for truth and prove adequate to answer his ceaseless yet intelligent questions? What is the true inner structure of reality? That's what we're looking for here, that will fulfill these requirements. I'm just struck by how much patience the masters have and how much they have to have, because things move very slowly here on the outer plane. And we're told that a great deal of patience has to be built up by people in incarnation, because when they're no longer in incarnation and they are trying to reach those who are, there will be a great delay in the recognition and assimilation of what they try to offer. Well, we'll see, and we probably have seen many times, you know, the river Lethe, the river of forgetfulness in Greek mythology, operates for all of us. And in the Kalevala here, the epic of Finland, there is supposedly the whirlpool in the head, which prevents the true structure of the inner worlds from reaching into the consciousness of all those except the initiates. So the whirlpool has to be controlled, tamed. I would assert here that the great and satisfying reply to all human questioning and human need is to be found in the doctrine of the avatars, and in the continuity of divine revelations. Now, there are certain religions that feel that their particular exponent or teacher or prophet has said the last word in religion. That, of course, is the result of the concrete mind seeking some kind of changelessness, resting place, you know. So, it's a great obstacle, and one day the people have to awaken to the obstructiveness of such an attitude. No one is having the last word, and even when the universe is resolved, given the reality of absolute infinity, there is no last word. There is no first word. There is paradox, and we have to find out how it operates. Excuse me. So, the satisfying reply has to do with the doctrine of the avatars, those who descend from a higher place to a lower place, bringing value to the lower place and without any motive of their own benefit. The higher ones descend without seeking anything for themselves. So it's a great expression of unselfishness. So this doctrine of the avatars and the continuity of divine revelation or revelations, both of these are great and satisfying replies to human questioning and human need and to man's ceaseless yet intelligent questioning. What is the truth? What is the truth? You know, probably Pilate thought he was being very clever and very intelligent by laughing at such a question, you know. But of course, he was exposed to such an intensity of a historical event that by now I'm sure he's learned. This is the persistent belief, ineradicable and unalterable, that at major moments of world need, God reveals himself through his appearances through a coming one. Now, for us, the Christ is the coming one. There has been, you know, the attempt recently in the Great Invocation to change the word Christ because of its religious connotation to the coming one. Okay, maybe that's going to work for some and maybe not for others, but for us, at least, we do know that there will be a coming one, and that coming one will be the Lord Maitreya, whom we have called the Christ, the anointed one, the christened one, the one who carries with him the great blessing of the higher worlds. So this doctrine of the coming one is found in all the basic world religions, even the basic ones too, huh? Okay, in every time and age. It appears in the doctrine of the avatars of the Hindu faith, in the teaching of the return of Maitreya Buddha, or the Kalki avatar, in the belief in the Western world in the return of the Christ and his advent and second coming, and in the prophesied issuing forth of the divine adventurer of the Muslim world, which is interesting. I guess this is being referred to as the Imam Mahdi. There are so many, just as in Christianity, there's so many divisions, and two main divisions in the Muslim world, and one of them particularly expects the return of the Mahdi, and maybe the other one does not. That's the impression I got. All this is tied up with the undying belief of mankind in the loving heart of God who ever meets man's need. The witness of history is that always the appearance of man's necessity has been met with divine revelation. And we can expect no different at this time. There is a great underlying forgivingness, a compassion, a giving of the gifts of the Spirit, you know, to name a book by Dane Rudyard, the giving of the gifts of the Spirit. which meet man's need in that hour of dire necessity, such as we are now passing through. The reason for this faith innate in the human heart is to be found in the fact of the nature of deity itself. The Christian statement, God is love, is founded on that deepest recognized spiritual path fact, especially, you know, God is many things, will, love, intelligence, but in our particular solar system, God is love. And love is a consuming fire. Our God is a consuming fire of love. What is consumed? Everything that obstructs love. The expression of this divine characteristic can be summed up from the voice of the silence, which was HPB's translation of the secret of the golden flower. Was that it? And a very fine little book, very inspiring book that charts the way ahead for the aspirant. Compassion is no attribute, it is the law of laws, eternal harmony, a Laya's self, a shoreless universal essence, the light of everlasting right and fitness of things. The law of love eternal. It's very beautiful. Very beautiful. And, you know, let us ponder on this. Certainly in our solar system, with a solar logos whose soul ray is the second ray, compassion issuing forth above all from the second ray of love and wisdom, this is correct for us. Now, when it, you know, and we tend to add qualities as we progress, because we're going into a first-ray solar system next time. It doesn't mean that we will lose intelligence of the first major solar system or the love of the second, while we practice the will and the will to good of the third and final solar system, except for the composite of all of them, which makes a seventh in some mysterious way. To this everlasting compassion, the cyclic appearance of the sun gods of the ancient myths, the world saviors and the avatars bear witness and are the guarantee. So it is right for us to assume a great tendency towards compassion. Tell you what, I don't know whether I have written anything further as far as the italics go, but I'm feeling a little bit on a roll, so I'm not going to stop myself right now. And I will go ahead emphasizing, I guess, whatever I emphasize. And if you find value in it, good. And if not, I'm sure you will have your own ideas. Okay, the Waysack Festival. Now, you know, this has been going on for a long time and is celebrated, we are told, in a valley in the Himalayas. Some of us went there in the year 2000 to be, you know, available on site for the Shambhala impact of that year. The people are operating according to a different calendar, and they would come according to a sidereal lunar calendar, and they came later. And so we were there quite alone, in a way. But we also have determined that when Master DK talked about the Waysack Festival in the West, he certainly gave the tropical zodiac a preeminence, and he did not work sidereally. So in that respect, we were correct. Now, do these appearances, do they actually externalize, or is the externalization on the etheric plane, and is this recorded astrally as well? That has yet to be answered, but there is a sense in which the etheric and the astral are what's involved here. In addition, of course, to the high energies working through these areas of the human energy system which are available to all human beings. At the time of this Waysak festival, I would call your attention to the fact that the annual return of the Buddha to bless his people everywhere, and to convey the message of wisdom, light, and love to humanity, coming as he does from the very heart of deity itself, I mean from within Shambhala, is the outer evidence and guarantee of inner divine guidance and revelation in the present world cycle of 25,000 years. I suppose it's still, in a way, when this was written, the end of the Piscean cycle, but certainly it was in an overlap period. As I've said and think, and other people think too, that with the coming into prominence of Sir Francis Bacon, the Age of Aquarius had its forerunner. Because he had so much in Aquarius in his chart, and he, you know, later was to become the Mahachohan, and he began all kinds of Aquarian reforms and directed man's mind towards science and experimentation, thus the fifth ray, which is prominently expressed through Aquarius. I'm not talking about the ray which accompanies the 2500-year period, which can be any ray, and according to a cycle which the interior ones know. I'm talking about that which Aquarius always expresses at this time, the fifth ray. And although Leo is the major expressor of the fifth ray, as we've been told, Aquarius soon will be. Year by year he returns, for a brief minute, 8 minutes really, right? Isn't that it? 8 minutes. He reminds us that God exists and ever loves, that he is he, God, the planetary logos, Sanat Kumara, as a representative of that logos and his extension, that he is not unmindful of his people, that the heart of the universe is unalterable compassion, and that man is not alone. To bring this recognition about and to make this appearance possible, a living triangle of energies is created and focused through three great spiritual individuals who evoke recognition both in the East and West. They are known to believers in every faith and in all and all nationalities, and these three are. Okay, so he, you know, the Buddha's reappearance, and, you know, here's the question, did it end somehow in 1981? There is that Waysak message of 1946, which seems to suggest there would be a change, but certainly at this time that this was written, the Buddha's return was very definite. So the heart of the universe, and do we mean by that our solar system? I mean, because, you know, three great qualities exist in every universe, the qualities of the three rays, the willpower, the love wisdom, and the intelligence, creativity, you might say. Okay. So, who are these three individuals that can make this happen? And we see them. The Lord of the World, the Ancient of Days, Sanat Kumara, the Planetary Logos, because he certainly is an extension of the Planetary Logos, Melchizedek, he to whom Christ referred when he said, I and my Father are one, as he prayed to Sanat Kumara at various times. And when we say the Lord's Prayer, it may be to Sanat Kumara, but it's also towards the solar logos, DK informs us. So the great Lord, whose nature we will increasingly understand and who seems to be at the center of many triangles and the great power behind them, such as at the center of the triangle of the Buddhas of activity. Now there's also the Buddha, the Illumined One, the Revealer of the Light, and the wisdom which comes to us from sources far greater than our planetary life, a messenger of the gods. Obviously, there's a lot of third ray here and a lot of Mercury, just as in the case of decay. And the Buddha's touch, which inspired him so at the sixth initiation, was apparently a touch on the cosmic, of the cosmic mental plane. You know, we don't, we don't know what level of the cosmic mental plane, but a touch from the cosmic mental plane. And then the Christ, the Son of the Father being, in this case, the Nakamara, the world's Savior, certainly the Savior during his Bodhisattvic period and maybe beyond, the Redeemer, he who has remained with us and who is gathering his sheep into his fold, the Lord of Love. There are different ways of describing these great beings, and we've just witnessed some of the descriptions. The Buddha and the Christ will be complete, I believe, their seventh initiation toward the end of the Aquarian Age, and they will pass on to higher modes of service. And eventually, you know, the Christ will tread the ray path, and is now, in a way, except he's remained here on the path of earth service, sacrificially, and many of the Chohans are now being asked to remain, to register their choice, and then remain, and only later go on the path of their choice. The Christ's path will be the ray path, where he will be an embodied ray of love wisdom, and eventually he again will make his way to Sirius. So at least we're told that no matter what his destination may be, he will eventually make his way to the great greater sun, the sunshine of the major sun, to the major sun, Sirius. So these three together make this Waysak a possibility. Now, eventually, interestingly, the Buddha is such a Taurian individual. You know, the idea, born at the full moon of Taurus, Taurus Scorpio, achieved his enlightenment of the sixth degree, because he was already the fifth degree head of the hierarchy at the full moon of Taurus, Taurus Scorpio, and then died with that same configuration. So he's totally identified with Taurus, but interestingly, so is the new group of world servers, identified with Taurus. And there'll be some way in which this group, when properly trained, will take up its function. And that function may be part of the function that the Buddha used to have. I know when I was in the arcane school, working there for a number of years, 5 years in New York, Mary Bailey had a strong idea that 1981 was going to be the year, maybe the last year, the Buddha would come at the Waysak Festival. And she always referred to the 1946 Waysak message. So, you know, whether this is so or not so, because there is flexibility on the inner side according to man's needs, one could draw that conclusion, I believe. And then the question is, you know, does one feel abandoned, or does one feel that the new group of world servers cannot possibly fill the role of the Buddha? But let's just say that I'm sure that the needs of the planet and the needs of humanity are met on this second ray planet with its second ray soul in a second ray solar system. It seems that there will not be a damaging hiatus there when the Buddha departs, whenever that may be, and maybe it hasn't even happened. Because he does have to remain supporting the Christ throughout the majority of the Age of Aquarius. He is one of the points in the triangle upholding the third ray point, which is part of his monadic configuration from cosmic fire. That seems inescapably true. In these three, whose nature is radiant love, light, and light, humanity can grasp in some measure the nature of divinity. Well, we're told of Sanatkumara, and you know the projection that he is of the planetary logos, that he is the greatest example of the teaching ray upon our planet, and he's a great lord of sacrifice. And, you know, he carries a kind of a second ray emphasis along with the first. So these three, all of them demonstrate radiant love and light. And of course, since they're anchored in Shambhala, they do demonstrate the will of God and the purpose. They are greater than is known or realized. Well, certainly, you know, conventional religion has only a very limited view of the Christ, and I'm sure that's the case in the East with the Buddha. DK tells us Buddhism becomes more and more dogmatic as we move along, and that is certainly possible. You know, there's quite a little conflict between the way DK presents Buddhism, supposedly a very high abbot of a great monastery, the Tibetan, and the way conventional Buddhism is presented, denying many of the things that the Buddha, DK presents. So in time, this has to be worked out. People oftentimes make their choice towards convention, and maybe later we'll discover that there was an aspect of esoteric Buddhism, which the Tibetan actually began to present to us. Okay, so they are greater than is known or realized. Human intelligence and aspiration can only sense their essential nature. Their spiritual potency, avatar of synthesis, right? All of these. Let's say the Christ, the Buddha, and Sanatkumara. But we cannot forget also the avatar of synthesis and the spirit of peace. And it's almost like there are five involved in this new revelation. Their spiritual potency has to be stepped down if mankind is to bear the pressure of the impact of the energy they wield and seek to transmit. It is this stepping down process which takes place at the time of the May full moon, and it is brought to a focus of transmission by the massed intent of the hierarchy and the massed demand of the world aspirants and disciples, itself drawn forth by the mass need of the people of all lands. So we do see the continuity here, don't we? And the way that even an inchoate invocation to meet need reaches up to the very highest places, and the needs are met. I think, you know, we will learn to discover the compassion side of our nature as we rise along the emanative chain, or the emanative stream, I call it, because that's what we're doing now. We're rising along that stream, and we will discover that it's always been a deeply essential part of our nature, as all the aspects of divinity are. So a hierarchy is needed here. The disciples and aspirants are needed, and the demand that must be met is that of humanity as a whole. And this is really how a transformer, an electric transformer, works. You just can't send certain voltages into forms that can't bear it. So there is a modulation always of the original intense energy to meet the capacity of those who receive. Here, my brothers, is a simple statement of the facts, which must be grasped by all of you who seek to participate intelligently in the Waysak Festival and are anxious to work as transmitters of the spiritual energy which will at that time be poured out onto suffering humanity. I think we can all understand this, right? And obviously, if we were faced with external crises of the kind that were occurring just 1 month before the invasion of Russia, we would be eager to help too. Obviously, the Tibetan knew of the amassing of forces there, opening up a two-front war for Germany and bringing untold suffering to the Russians and to minorities within Russia, you know, bringing great suffering through this invasion. This Waysak Festival in 1941, you know, we could go there and find out when it would be. I mean, how would I do that, you know? You know, just bear with me here for a second. I might try to change this a little bit. So here is Transits for 2019, but let's just, you know, suppose we wanted to somehow change this altogether and say this is February of 1940. Okay, because, you know, that's a little bit before, isn't it? And then we would look up here. This is not an advertisement for Solar Fire software, but they're very good, very good. And here it is, 1940, 1941, and the Waysak Festival is when? Here it is, May the 11th. And here in Finland, it would be at 7:15 in the morning, and in the United States and the East Coast, probably be something like 12 midnight, you know. Anyway, this time has passed, but there it is in the middle of May, 1941, the actual full moon in Taurus. Okay, well, that's how you find it, you see. Okay, that's fine. And we get rid of that. And do we need it? No, we don't need it. And now we can, yeah, we'll let it go. So the Waysak Festival in 1941 can prove to be a changer of conditions and a major turning point in the life of mankind if every spiritually minded person can bring himself to the needed point of selflessness, discipline, purity, and resultant receptivity. DK is holding out very high hopes for the marshaling of the energies. Of course, you know, the war did go on, so probably the full ideal of what he had hoped did not materialize, but he always offers opportunity, doesn't he? And he always tries to charge us with a sense of responsibility. There are certain fundamental truths which lie behind all revealed religions. They are essential to the spiritual growth and the progressive realizations of divinity by man. Certain fundamental truths. Okay, that's the main idea here, and they are found in all the revealed religions. Okay. They are essential to the spiritual growth and the progressive realizations of divinity by man. All else found under the term doctrine and allied phrases are but expansions of these fundamentals, explanatory in nature, expressive of human interpretations and formulations of the evolutionary recognitions. So it's the fundamentals. There are certain fundamentals of truth. That's what, and everything else is derivative. That's what we're finding out here. Yep, everything else stems from them. Okay. These are mainly additions and are in the nature of adornment, speculation, and prediction. They are constantly subject to change, to rejection or development as man's intellect and spiritual perception unfolds. They are not basic or unalterable. These human, let's just say, not necessarily divine additions. It is the unalterable truths which must be discovered and recognized as the new world religion takes form on earth and conditions human thought and consciousness in the coming new age. All right, that's what we're looking for, that which, in Masonry, it's like the ancient landmarks. They always abide, as DK has told us in the Spirit of Masonry, that he wrote, basically, taken down by Alice Bailey and put out under the name of Foster Bailey, so it would be accepted. Because, a woman Mason in those days, and especially a new kind of deviant lodge based on esotericism, well, it wouldn't receive the kind of verification that something put out by a male Mason would. So the basic truths of all world religions, right? Isn't it so? Of all revealed religions, fundamental. These basic truths never change because they are related to the nature of deity itself and have become apparent to mankind through revelation. As evolution has proceeded and man has developed the needed perceptive faculties and the required persistence of search, plus the unfolding of the inner light of the soul. So we're looking for the basic truths that underlie all of these revealed religions, and I'm sure we'll find a commonality here, no matter what the religion may be, Taoism, Hinduism, Brahmanism, Christianity, Islam, Judaism, whatever may be the form. And there's so many different approaches. These truths inherent in divine nature reveal the soul of God. All right. And they are. The law of compassion. This is the truth of right relationship, of loving understanding, of actively expressed love. It is the foundation of brotherhood and the expression of inner unity, a gift of Venus and Neptune. One might say the law of compassion. Now, there are some religions that really don't emphasize that. They emphasize compassion to their own, but mistrust and hostility and the right to conquer with respect to other religions. Obviously, they have a ways to go before they realize this law of compassion, but there are, for instance, some sects or aspects of such religions which do grasp the law of compassion, and as you can imagine, they are persecuted by those who deem themselves strict adherents of original doctrine. Okay, the fact of God. So let's see what I can do here. I just want to make this, I think I did, the law of compassion. And I just kind of put that down so it stands out. The fact of God, this is the truth that being is God immanent and transcendent. It's hard for people to grasp this because the mind is structured the way it is. Things other than oneself always seem external. Well, God is not other than oneself or other than the self, but it takes a lot of experience to recognize that that is the case. The fact of God. All right. Okay, so God is both immanent and transcendent. Not only is God within you, but you are God. And that's where the attack comes in, and you're considered to be a heretic, you know. It involves the recognition of the great whole and the related parts. It is the knowledge of divinity ascertained through right relationship and identity of origin. See? Identity of origin. Everything emanates from the one great being and is essentially the one great being, though different as part perceives part. It is the revelation of the life of God, pervading all that is God immanent, and of that same life providing the still greater cosmic relation, God transcendent, which is the final guarantee of all progress and of progressive revelation. This important statement now, and you know it, having pervaded this whole universe with a fragment of myself, I remain, is the challenge of deity and the eternal hope of humanity. The Solar Angel says this, you know, when it underlies the matter of the higher mental plane and builds for man an egoic lotus. That egoic lotus can, of course, be built otherwise when there is no Solar Angel, but it's a much slower process. This is the answer of life to the demands of humanity, this descent, this pervasion, this presence within, to the inquiries of science and to the whole world problem, really. God is here, present among us, and in all forms of expression. He includes, pervades, and remains beyond. He includes, pervades, that's immanence, and remaining beyond is transcendence. He is greater than all appearance. He reveals himself progressively and cyclically as man gets ready for further knowledge. All right, well, these are important paragraphs, really, aren't they? I find them important. And let's see, how will we do this? Just grasping what God is, you know, and the fact that there can be no way to be excommunicated essentially. It's a perception that comes when one's form is not adequate to the registration of the ever-present God. This idea of excommunication held over people's heads is a great threat. Excommunication and eternal hellfire. Well, you kind of wonder what kind of human mind, certainly not very humane, thought that one up. And that's going back a long way, as it was found in pre-Christian approaches also. So, the law of compassion, the fact of God, these are the fundamentals, the continuity of revelation. So important. As I said, you know, so many, well, there's the tendency for certain religions to dead end, using it as a verb, run into a wall because they imagine that what their beloved teacher or prophet has said is forever, forever true. Little knowing about the law of mutation and the constant evolution of all aspects of the universe as a kind of emanative return, these thoughts are not brought into consideration. I think, you know, maybe Giordano Bruno was had a sharp tongue, and he wrote plays, and he satirized the church and various individuals, but it was because of his expansive thought that he was killed, murdered, you know, burned, gagged. I mean, well, you know, disgusting. But it's the reaction of the orthodox concrete mind to the possibility of expanded perception. The ordinary concrete mind is horrified at what the expanded perception might be able to reveal. And that horror, you know, leads to violence, the attempt to eliminate the one who brings the expansive possibility. That's nothing new. That happens so frequently. It's what the Inquisition was frequently about, you know, some kind of apparent purification meant to preserve the doctrinal comfort of the believers, and hence to leave power in the hands of the priesthood and so forth. Ever down the ages and at each human crisis, always in the hours of necessity, at the founding of a new race, or in the awakening of a prepared humanity to a new and wider vision, I think that's what we face now, that the heart of God, impelled by the law of compassion, sends forth a teacher, a world savior, an illuminator, an avatar. He gives the message which will heal, which will indicate the next step to be taken by the race, which will illumine a dark world problem, and give to man an expression of a hitherto unrealized aspect of divinity. Maybe, you know, before the Christ came, love was not so emphasized, and he was the one who was able to bring love forward as something really to be reckoned with in the field of spirituality. Upon this fact of the continuity of revelation, and upon the sequence of this progressive manifestation of the divine nature, is based the doctrine of the avatars, of divine messengers, divine appearances, and inspired prophets. To all these, history unmistakably testifies. So, you know, we just can count that the light will, count on the fact the light will ever increase, and we have to be open to that. The continuity of revelation, so much would be solved now if people would not hang desperately upon the changelessness of that which has been given to them, and for which reason they fight other revelations that threaten that changelessness. They especially fight the new. To the reactionary, there's nothing worse than the new, which threatens the fortress of form in which he believes. When we think about these things, we see what humanity is passing through right now. And, you know, how people want to keep things just the way they have been. Now, the next factor that is fundamental to the true revelation, the inevitable response of humanity. I have expressed in these simple words the instinctive spiritual, you know, spiritual instinct, first initiation, right? I have expressed in these simple words the instinctive spiritual reaction of man and of the undying human spirit to the three above foundational truths, you know, and let's review them. All right, something's happened here. And they are the law of compassion, the fact of God, both immanent and transcendent, and the continuity of revelation. People really choke on that one, but they find security in changelessness. And that would be a prison, of course. And then the inevitable response of humanity. That is to be expected. So I've indicated, he says, the instinctual spiritual reaction of man and of the undying human spirit to these above foundational truths. This divine spirit in humanity must ever, and most surely does, respond to the divine appearance. The witness to this is sure and proven. There is that in mankind which is akin to God and which recognizes its own when it appears. The divinity within us, immanent, recognizes the more pervasive divinity appearing all around. Such is the unshakable reality in the human heart, and the recognition of the inevitable reward and result of revelation. So, you know, it's fear that really is preventing us from responding as we should to the great revelations, which so often we reject as threatening. They threaten what we are holding on for dear life, or should I call it dear death, to render us secure. Progress, transcendence, other things. That seems to be it. So this is an important chapter on the doctrine of the avatars. Now here's progress. And we will accentuate that. Probably these were italicized in some ways, but we'll get the idea here. It'll be enough. Okay, there's progress. It's gotten bigger and bigger. That's progress, right? Okay. The reaction of the individual man and of the masses of men to the continuity of revelation historically proved. And that's so important because people can deny it, but we just go back into even that tiny history of humanity, which we do have, and we will see the emerging of the teachers, of the leaders, of the inspirers, and so forth. Historically proved cannot be denied. It is the basic fact of religion. The types of that revelation may vary, but each new revelation given in response to human need and demand has ever led humanity onwards towards a steady brightening goal and a greater glory. And that's really important. I remember DK was talking about, was it Vyasya? He was talking about this continuity of appearing teachers and that the whole message of immortality came from Vyasya. I believe that was his name. We hear of him, you know, in Hindu mythology, and certainly with the kind of hope given there for immortality when it had been crushed out by materialistic perception, aided and abetted by the obstructive Black Lodge, that hope has led people onward towards a steadily brightening goal and a greater glory. The revelation may come on varying levels of human consciousness. It may be the revelation of new lands to conquer. Well, that's often a first-rate kind of revelation, as when the Hebrews of ancient days saw Canaan and transposed that perception into their dream of the promised land, which came from an earlier solar system altogether. It may be the revelation of new lands to conquer, terrestrial or mental. You know, and DK tells us about the second-rate type that his highest attainments are never enough in the field of knowledge. Some person pointed the way. It may be the recognition of new laws and facts in nature, scientifically grasped and used. I mean, E equals MC squared was such a thing. That formula was not in the possession of humanity before Einstein wrested it from the inner ashram. It may be the response of intelligent man to increased knowledge, producing a new type of civilization, Lord of Civilization, Third Ray. Some liberated spirit pointed the way, always some exponent of a ray, which is the quality of that which must emerge. It may be the response of the human heart to the heart of God, leading in to the mystical beatitude and to the recognition of spiritual being. Well, the great religions bring this forward, and the Sermon of the Mount must have been really something to hear. It may be the reaction of man to some new teaching, some further unfoldment resulting in a new and enriched religious approach to the center of life. Some messenger pointed the way. You know, he has this litany going about how important it is for people to emerge from the heart of God, pointing the way ever on further, ever on ahead. But always it has meant progress, a moving forward, a rejection of some existing limitation, a repudiating of the undesirable and the evil. Always it involves the recognition of the possible, the ideal, and the divine. You know, eventually for us and immediately ahead, it's the recognition of the monad. So some messenger, some teacher, some illuminator, some conqueror, you know, whatever name you want to use, pointed the way. pointed the way ahead. And, you know, because of that litany that he uses, you know how important it is. So Revelation, what is the assumption here? That, I'll just say it, write it maybe in this way, that continuity of Revelation brings continuity of progress for the human race. I think, you know, we cannot find fault with that. And, you know, our period of consciousness in this universe is very, very slight so far, self-consciousness, compared to what lies ahead for us. I think just the way the history of humanity has been much compressed by the best minds of science at the moment, so that what took place millions and millions of years ago is not even reckoned as indicating an intelligent humanity, much less, I mean, a civilized humanity, in the same way. What lies ahead can hardly be fathomed. The universe is given a much shorter expected duration than will, according to the occult chronology, be the case. And of course, completely ignored is the whole inner universe and its possible duration. I mean, when you have even the duration of a solar logos, according to the Hindu chronology, lasting some 340 billion years, and science tells you your universe is going to last 15 billion to 18 billion years. There's a huge discrepancy. Let's see who turns out to be correct. Basically, we've been told by Master KH that scientists who study geology will have many theories to revise as the necessary discoveries are made. The last 200 years, you know, I mean, we had, I think, from Bishop Usher, the idea that the world was created in 4004 BC and at 9 o'clock in the morning. Okay, well, you know, the absurdity of that in the face of modern discoveries is patent to us, but it wasn't patent to the people who believed it at the time, and it made things so small and so compressed that they seemed manageable. That was the point. Make man comfortable. Don't advance theories that make man uncomfortable, or you're liable to pay the price. And then when it comes further to the foundations of religion, the true fundamentals, we have transcendence. And this means the innate capacity to pass beyond so-called natural law. The innate capacity to pass beyond so-called. Now, DK does a good job, I think, in Treatise on Cosmic Fire dealing with natural law. But this is the higher aspects of man are transcendental, you know? And, well, maybe there's a difference we could make between transcendent and transcendental. Right. And this means the innate capacity to pass beyond so-called natural law and to obey laws that the great majority of humanity don't believe even exist, nor the worlds to which they pertain. So, as usual, there's a lot of education to be done, a lot of light to shed, and fortunately, the consciousness movement has seen among millions the absorption of this new light and the revelation that comes from the new light. Now, I don't know, are they getting older now, and will they go out of incarnation? But if so, they'll come back. Those who are the vanguard of spiritual thinking and not going to succumb to the materialistic side of Aquarius. You know, we've been told there will be magicians in the coming age. They will be strictly mental magicians. They will not have the heart active. They will not practice white magic. But obviously, there is a group in whom the heart is active. They will practice white magic, the white magic of the plan, and that steadily reappearing, cyclically reappearing group, mostly on the second ray, has a lot of work to do. We're told the day of opportunity may not be with us forever. It won't be. And even in 2075, the 500-year second ray cycle ends. But okay, the presence of the Christ and of his hierarchy, such a strong second ray presence will reinforce the second ray, even though the 500-year cyclic period has come to an end. So this surmounting of limitation is ever taking place, and this process of transcendence will call forth increasing recognition. There was a movement 200 years ago in the middle of the 19th century, maybe 150 years ago, called Transcendentalism. And Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry Thoreau and people of that ilk were involved in it, and it probably was the result of the discovery of Neptune and its quality becoming more generally available. So anyway, the transcendence, and already you can see that taking place, and during the consciousness revolution, as I keep on calling it that, I lived through it, you know, so it feels to me that it was so. There is a great respect for that which goes beyond. The drug culture, of course, tried to find a material way to pass beyond, and maybe some people did that to a certain extent, but mostly it released people onto the astral plane and into areas of consciousness they couldn't handle. So you have to kind of make your own drugs in your brain, you know. And it will be discovered that when people have those transcendent visions, that there are substances in the brain which have been generated and are correlated with those visions. So anyway, this recognition of transcendence marks the next major phase in the manifestation of divinity in man. It marks the next major phase of the manifestation of divinity in man. And when we start, you know, looking at the etheric body as the bioelectric field is really part of man, then what is man after all? And maybe the what should we call it? The constitution of man, as presented in occultism, will be honored and will be investigated. And then the time will come when the scientific discovery of that level of nature we call the soul will be proven. So we're heading within, but that doesn't mean that we don't transform things without. Both are needed. The hierarchy knows that, and we have to stand in imitation of that hierarchy. So anyway, this phase of transcendence, it signifies domination over physical law and humanity's imminent triumph over the forces which have so long held it to earth. So new energies are coming, and new conquests of a spiritual nature are on their way. And this is largely unsuspected. And, you know, imagine this is written 80 years ago, but how much more this should be the case now, that instrumentation has increased in sensitivity and some of these subtle fields are actually being detected. Of this transcendent, the present mystery over the air, or mastery, sorry, mastery over the air is the symbol. You know, and there were days when we couldn't fly like the birds, right? And have you seen the airplanes now? Of course, that's not quite the same as beam me up, Scotty, you know? And the transposition of material arrangement through space Of this transcendence, the present mastery over the air is the symbol. Man is rapidly mastering the four elements. He cultivates the earth, he rides the waters and goes beneath them. He controls the electrical fires of the planet, that is, through electricity, and he flies triumphantly through the air. The question now emerges, what, my brothers, next? Another transcendence lies ahead. It is one of the things which the coming avatar will reveal. So, you know, we have four of the, at least three, of the subplanes of the etheric physical plane, of the systemic etheric physical plane, in process of conquest, and what about the ethers? More is to come. Always there will be transcendence, and even at the end of a universe, there is transcendence into the self-perception of the absolute deity, which is absolute infinity. Okay, with the lesser leaders whom the human spirit evokes to its assistance, I shall not deal. I seek to unfold somewhat the doctrine of divine messengers, of avatars. From whence come they? What is their nature? Who are they? And what is their relation to humanity, to the hierarchy, and to still greater groups of lives? These are questions which normally arise and need clear answering. Well, let's see if there... I've gone beyond an hour, but at the same time, it may not be possible to continue here. Let's just see. Well, what I'm going to do, and it won't take too long, is go down to the beginning of the next chapter or section, which is on divine intervention. But I think I can stay with this for a little while here, as we think that humanity's needs are answered by various kinds of avatars. They are invoked and thus evoked. And there's a bit more here that can define their nature, and I think we can take that up now. An avatar is a being who, having first developed his own nature, human and divine, and then transcended it, is capable of reflecting some cosmic principle or divine quality and energy which will produce the desired effect upon humanity, evoking a reaction, producing a needed stimulation, and as it is esoterically called, leading to the rending of a veil and the permeation of light. Wonderful definition. You know, and because the Christ and the Buddha have both had cosmic touches in their sixth initiation process, they are both avatars. There are higher avatars, of course, and on it goes. But this is so interesting that they do bring a kind of liberation because they do rend the veil for an encapsulated or curtained or cloaked humanity. And there are also avatars that relate to the other kingdoms. I'm thinking about, you know, Steve Irwin. It's some kind of anniversary of his death recently, and his involvement with the animal kingdom was extraordinary. And he was stabbed in the heart by a stingray, you know. Some people think, well, why didn't he leave those animals alone? But his intention was good. And he was able to bring a closer relation of humanity to the animal kingdom. And there's been generally a war between the lord of the human kingdom and the lord of the animal kingdom. And he seems to be, he was reducing that. And, you know, he paid a price, a big price. It's so symbolic, amazing. But anyway, his orientation, it seemed, was even more towards the animal kingdom than towards the human, and he was creating a bridge. And maybe there are, you know, as humanity assumes its proper role, avatars towards the plant kingdom and even the mineral. Will they be recognized? Certainly they're not recognized by the unconscious kingdoms. Maybe a little light comes in the animal kingdom. Anyway, there are multiple definitions of avatars, and this is a good one. Develop yourself and go further, and then bring it down to stimulate a group that needs the stimulation and give them a measure of freedom through that stimulation. And all of this is an act of pure altruism. It's not so that you can gain anything from it. Some engage with the lower kingdom, not only for the benefit of the lower kingdom, but so that they themselves may do something necessary and thereby gain. But DK talks later about the fact that avatars descend without any thought of gain. So the permeation of light, leading to the rending of the veil and the permeation of light. Christ, you know, his sacrifice rent the veil of the temple in twain. Now, you know, is that a literal fact, and did it symbolically occur on the outer plane, or was it so that the possibility of rending the Temple of Solomon, the veil over the Temple of Solomon or within the Temple of Solomon, achieved some kind of stimulation, and it became easier for people to leave the confines of the causal body. This energy may be generated within the human family and focused in a responsive messenger. It may be generated within the planet itself and produce a planetary avatar. Well, maybe a responsive messenger is someone like Lincoln. He's a racial avatar. And quite the opposite of Bismarck, according to the Tibetan, who, being an avatar of blood and iron, you know, represented Mars. He even was an Aries, and representing the lords of form and of dominance. Both were on the first ray, of course. This energy may be generated within the human family and focused in a responsive messenger. It may be generated within the planet itself and produce a planetary avatar. It may be the expression of the life impulse and energy of a solar system. Maybe, I'm not sure yet, but maybe the avatar of synthesis and the spirit of peace are intra-solar systemic avatars who have a particular relation to the solar logos, or of sources outside the solar system and therefore cosmic. For instance, an avatar from Sirius, as we've been told, entering our solar system, and very infrequently. But always it is focused through a manifesting entity, is called forth by, and of course that entity may be a projection of the avatar itself, is called forth by a demand or mass appeal. The Lords of Liberation, in that sense, were avataric during the Second World War, and evokes response and consequent changes in the life activity, the culture, and the civilization of mankind. We are thinking very much now of avatars in relation to humanity and not the other kingdoms. I suppose all kingdoms have their liberating avatars. It all seems like in the universe, there's always help from above to below. The response or reaction of humanity to the divine messenger establishes in due time the recognition of something transcendent, something to be desired and striven for, something which indicates a vision which is first a possibility and later an achievement. Think of Master DK. He's still a master, and he's not an avatar in the sense that he is describing, but he is, sorry, he is a divine messenger, and ideally suited due to his learning to present this teaching to a wide range of people, and he was given permission to do so, to descend from above, and to offer to those who needed the light, extra light, additional light. Anyway, there will be a messenger from on high. The messenger has achieved within himself that which lower points of focus require for their own growth and for relief and for general progress, and the divine messenger descends selflessly, and in many cases, I would say, with no motive other than to help, no real possible growth for the messenger. But, you know, you can't help but think that the one who gives and gives and gives somehow benefits, you know, to those who give all is given. Now, all of this is historically proven, the historically proven process, and testifies eventually to a fact. This new fact, when added to the facts established by other and earlier avatars, enriches the spiritual content of the human consciousness, enhances the spiritual life of the race, and stimulates man to move a step forward in the world of reality. And out of the world of illusion, each revelation brings him nearer to the world of causes. So, some kind of spiritual gain or fact, some solid landmark is established by the avatar. This testifies eventually to a fact. Now, you know, you kind of think about what, you know, on a lower level than some of these planetary and systemic and cosmic avatars. But Lincoln, as a racial avatar, you know, he brought freedom through the Emancipation Proclamation. He is said to have freed the slaves, at least in principle. It took a long time to work out, and it corrected a great error on the part of the colonists who continued the slave trade by offering money for the slaves. It would have dried up immediately if there was no demand. And Lincoln corrected that, and he was, on a little human level, an avatar of synthesis. Think about that. Why would that be so? Lincoln as an avatar of synthesis. Well, you know, not as this superior being, this superior solar systemic or trans-solar systemic being is, but Lincoln held the union together. He insisted on not letting the split occur. He would not tolerate division. And, you know, he had so many of the final signs in his chart: Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, and Pisces, all of them present, and all of them climactic, synthetic, spiritual signs, or at least, you know, from the time we get to Capricorn, it was so. I've done his chart, you know, this question about what it really is. Some people think it's Aquarius rising as well as the sun in Aquarius, but I'm pretty sure it's Sagittarius rising with the sun in Aquarius, the moon in Capricorn, and certain important Pisces planets. At the present time, the avatar is most easily recognized and known are the Buddha and the Christ, because their messages are familiar to all, and the fruits of their lives and words have conditioned the thinking and civilization of both hemispheres. They had a huge scope of influence, both hemispheres. And on, you know, a higher level, initiatorily higher level than Lincoln, yes. Because they were, in a way, planetary avatars, the Buddha and the Christ. Because they are divine human avatars, they had achieved the sixth initiation, or did so when they were in incarnation, and divinity in a way begins at the sixth plane from below, or the second from above, and extends onto the seventh logoic plane, because they are divine human avatars and represent something which humanity can more easily understand, because they are of like nature to mankind. In other words, we do understand divinity through these two great avatars, flesh of our flesh and spirit of our spirit. Because of all this, they mean more to us than other divine emergences, which may be more powerful, of course. They are known and loved and followed by countless millions. I would ask you to ponder on the potency of the nucleus of force which they have set up. The establishing of a nucleus of energy spiritually positive is the constant task of an avatar. So I'll tell you what, I will copy this much. They've conditioned millions and millions and have set up a center of force to which today, 2,000 years later, 2,500 years later, people are still responding. And without that center of force which they established and the idea of their presence, so many would be in despair, you know. The establishing of a nucleus of force, nucleus of energy, spiritually positive, is the constant task of an avatar. So that's one of those emblazoned sentences. The establishment of a nucleus of energy, spiritually positive, is the constant task of an avatar. So much depends on what they do. So many people that stick with humanity will succeed or fail because of the presence of this spiritually positive center of energy, nucleus of energy, and really because of the presence of the avatar behind the scenes. The Christ is always present, and even the Buddha comes from a very, very high position as a representative of our planetary God, and is present among us. Well, he's always present, of course, but present among us more visibly for 8 minutes a year. So what does an avatar do? He focuses or anchors a dynamic truth, a potent thought form, or a vortex of attractive energy in the three worlds of human living. Then, as the centuries have passed, that truth and the effect of their lives and words begin steadily to condition human thinking. I mean, let's just say the Christianity did not spread all over the world immediately. It had to be cultivated, and cultivated at great sacrifice by so many, you know. I mean, you think about Nero, you know, taking the Christians and using them as torches. You think about the Christians being thrown to the lions, and hungry lions at that. The sacrifices were many, and in some ways horrific, unthinkable, but that nurtured the viability of the religion, which since has spread all over the world. And many of the sacrifices of the adherents of the Buddha, as alone they conquered themselves in the caves through meditation. It's a different method, perhaps, but they conquered Mara, the opponent, just as the Buddha had. The established thought form that they bring increasingly acts as a transmitter of divine energy, as it expresses a divine idea. And this, in time, produces civilization with its accompanying culture, religions, policies, and educational processes. So they really bring for humanity great structures of training and of the cultivation of values such as civilizations. Without the seed, there would be no civilization. So they are not lords of history per se, but because of their gift, history is made. Thus is history is made. Thus is history made. It says, history is but the record of man's cyclic reaction to some inflowing divine energy, to some avatar or some inspired leader. This is a great statement, and maybe not how we would normally have described what history is, you know, simply a record of what has happened. Well, it's more than that. It's the record of man's cyclic reaction, because they do come in cycles, these avatars, to some inflowing divine energy, to some avatar or some inspired leader. So great are these positive influences coming from above the normal vibratory level and conditioning the forms through which we relate to each other within humanity. Well, you know, I had a failure of my chronometer again, of course. So from 293, somewhere here, huh? From 293, okay. And I guess the not using the italics didn't hurt too much. From 285 to 293. So 282, really some pages are skipped. 293. And let's see how that works out here to keep some kind of continuity going so we understand where we've been. It's really important. You know how it is, you want to be understood, you say what you say, then you you say what you're going to say, then you say it, and then you tell your audience what you've said. That is a story. Okay, so that's number 9, and basically we've gone from 282, kind of, from 282 to 290. Five, I guess. Is that correct? Oh, 293, excuse me. 282 to 293. And we'll begin with program 30. So this is about 1.5 hours, very loosely, 1.5 hours. And we start with 293, and this is the 23rd of February, and we don't know when we pick it up. Tomorrow, Sunday, maybe there'll be a little time. I become quite anxious, you know, to complete these things, but one learns to have patience because there are many things upon the physical plane which have to be solved. Okay, friends, I appreciate very much your presence, and we will continue to move forward. We've done about 230 pages or so in this book, and it's a long book. The whole thing may not be done for another year, year and a half. Let's see. And the closer we get to the end, the more current it becomes, but we still do need Master DK's interpretation in his forthcoming installments of the teaching. His bridging treatises, we need what he thinks of what's happened during the last 75 or 80 years. We need that from 1950 and 1949 to 2025 and following. We want to get his evaluation, his assessment of the time we have lived through, how the hierarchy views what has happened. And I'm sure that retrospective has to come. The big question is, how will we recognize that it is Master DK writing when so many excitable and ambitious people want to be the amanuensis? Well, first of all, that attitude rather disqualifies them. I think it's all going to be done quite quietly, and the Just as Alice Bailey, who didn't want to take down the Tibetan's words, judged after reading that indeed this was a worthy source, so it must be for humanity, and especially for the spiritual students at first, to judge that it's really the Tibetan behind this and not some pretender. I mean, you know, pretenders are fine, but I think they should just admit that this is their thought rather than some conjured image, you know, because in the case of every pretender, you just know they could have written it themselves. And all you have to do is open Initiation Human and Solar, and you just know that Alice Bailey couldn't write that herself, and no ordinary human being could as well. So we have to have keen discrimination, keen spiritual discernment, in order to judge aright when the time comes. And the time is imminent, imminent, with an I. Okay. See you soon. Lots of love, many blessings, and let's continue to study, meditate, and apply. That is, to serve. Bye-bye.